So today, we're continuing on in the Beatitudes. And today's topic is, blessed are those who are meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And as I did last week, I'd like to read them out at the beginning, just so that we have the whole Beatitudes in our mind, in our framework, to just kind of be thinking about them as we enter into discussion about how they work out in our life. So I'm going to read again from the English Standard Version today. Seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you, and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." So we've been talking about the bigger picture of the unfolding of the kingdom of heaven, how that breaks into our lives, breaks into who we are as a people, and helps define what it is to live out the life of Jesus in our everyday opportunities. And I've mentioned a few times how Walter Brueggemann's language and his ideas and how he coins phrases have really been in the back of my mind and have come out in language more than I even realized. And he often talks about this, a different way of being in the world, and that is to live out the implications of resurrection in who we are. I talked a little bit about Matthew 5:1-12, not being an ideal, but being the reality that the kingdom of heaven has indeed come near in Jesus Christ, and what the people of God, as they work this out, will look like as a community, that they will represent that it's wonderful news for these people because Jesus has come and he has dwelt among us and he has died and is raised from the dead. And I threw Brueggemann out there right at the beginning because I'd like to talk about a psalm as we begin, as we wrestle with what this passage means for us. And it's Psalm 37, and it's on page 819 in your pew Bibles. And as you're flipping through and looking forward, I'm going to talk a little bit around that. And the reason why I'd like to read through this psalm and kind of talk about it a little bit will become clear as I read it out. And the connection it has with Matthew 5:5. And I've made a couple changes when I read this out from the New Living Translation. I've substituted every case that has land, I've substituted with earth, which will become apparent later. And this reflects how the Greek translation of the Hebrew text is. They have the more generic word for earth as opposed to land. And also I've made plain that one verse that really connects the two. Again, reflecting the language of the Greek in the translation of the Hebrew, which reflects also the Hebrew. Okay, Psalms. As we talked about last summer, it's always a thing of debate about the primary situation of the Psalms, or where they begin, and how the psalmist is responding to the situation. There's different ways of reading the Psalms, of interpreting them, and finding what that situation of life and how they might speak into the lives of the people reading it, and how then that continues forth into our lives, and as we wrestle with what it is to be in the world, what it is to understand God in this manner, in this way. And Brueggemann, in dealing with this psalm, provides two interpretations that he discusses, and we'll get to that after reading Psalm 37. As I'm sure you've already realized, it is 40 verses long, so please bear with me, but it is worthwhile. Last week I made the joke that I wanted to read all of Isaiah 56 to 66, so 40 verses isn't that bad. All right, Psalm 37. "Don't worry about the wicked or envy those who do wrong, for they like grass. For like grass they soon fade away. Like spring flowers they soon wither. Trust in the Lord and do good. Then you will live safely in the earth and prosper. Take delight in the Lord and he will give you your heart's desires. Commit everything you do to the Lord. Trust him and he will help you. He will make your innocence radiant like the dawn, and the justice of your cause will shine like the noonday sun. Be still in the presence of the Lord and wait patiently for him to act. Don't worry about evil people who prosper or fret about their wicked schemes. Stop being angry. Turn from your rage. Do not lose your temper. It only leads to harm. For the wicked will be destroyed. Those who trust in the Lord will possess the earth. Soon the wicked will disappear. Though you look on them, they will be gone. The meek will inherit the earth and will live in peace and prosperity. The wicked plot against the godly. They snarl at them in defiance. But the Lord just laughs, for he sees their day of judgment coming. The wicked draw their swords and string their bows to kill the poor and the oppressed, to slaughter those who do right. But their swords will stab their own hearts, and their bows will be broken. It is better to be godly and to have little than to be evil and rich. For the strength of the wicked will be shattered, but the Lord takes care of the godly. Day by day, the Lord takes care of the innocent. They will receive an inheritance that lasts forever. They will not be disgraced in hard times. Even in famine, they will have more than enough. But the wicked will die. The Lord's enemies are like flowers in a field. They will disappear like smoke. The wicked borrow and never repay, but the godly are generous givers. Those the Lord blesses will possess the earth, but those he curses will die. The Lord directs the steps of the godly. He delights in every detail of their lives. Though they stumble, they will never fall, for the Lord holds them by the hand. Once I was young and now I am old, yet I have never seen the godly abandoned or their children begging for bread. The godly always give generous loans to others, and their children are a blessing. Turn from evil and do good, and you will live in the earth forever. For the Lord loves justice, and he will never abandon the godly. He will keep them safe forever, but the children of the wicked will die. The godly will possess the earth and will live there forever. The godly offer good counsel. They teach right from wrong. They have made God's law their own, so they will never slip from his path. The wicked wait in ambush for the godly, looking for an excuse to kill them. The Lord will not let the wicked succeed, or let the godly be condemned when they are put on trial. Put your hope in the Lord. Travel steadily along his path. He will honor you by giving you the earth. You will see the wicked destroyed. I have seen wicked and ruthless people flourishing like a tree in its native soil. When I looked again, they were gone. Though I searched for them, I could not find them. Look at those who are honest and good, for a wonderful future await those who love peace. But the rebellious will be destroyed. They have no future. The Lord rescues the godly. He is their fortress in times of trouble. The Lord helps them, rescuing them from the wicked. He saves them, and they will find shelter in him. So Walter Brueggemann proposes two reading situations, or discusses two possible reading situations with this psalm. And the first one fits in this idea of what would be called a wisdom psalm, where it talks about how the world operates, how things are. And that is describing those who possess the land and kind of creating an apology for having the land, that they've done righteously, that they've done things correct, and then therefore they have this land, they have the rights to their possession, and they have this permanent security, this peace and prosperity. And this reflects the outlook of Proverbs in many ways. There's often these statements and declarations that if you behave righteously, if you do righteousness, then God will bless you and you'll have safety and security and peace and prosperity. And this is kind of the ancient Near East or the Hebrew Bible, health and wealth, and that's where things come out of it, at least in the origin of it. But then you have this statement here that we see in verses 25 and 26, where the psalmist describes a situation where he's never seen the children of the righteous begging for bread, or describes this so utopian situation that you have to stand back from the text and question, well, is this really the way things operate? Is this really the truth of life? And I think we don't have to think about too many situations to realize that doing the right thing doesn't always bring wealth and prosperity and safety and security and blessing, that there are still times, many examples, where that is not the case, and perhaps even the reverse or the opposite of it. And to even describe some of these situations would then be almost trivializing those type of situations, because we see injustice for those who do right. We see people lacking, even though they're not committing evil, they're not committing extortion or the like. So we question this psalm as we read it. Is this really the way things work in life? Is this really how things always operate? Which then brings us to Brueggemann's second reading, which brings him to this other place of questioning. And that is where the status quo of the situation is different. The status quo is injustice, where the people who are behaving righteously, who are trying to follow after Yahweh, to walk in his path, are actually the ones who are denied the land, denied access to the things that they need in the proper situation. As Brueggemann writes here, the psalm is turned back against the wicked who now possess the very land that had been promised to the meek and will indeed be given to them. And it continues as well. Psalm 37 is an act of utopian hope, that is, an affirmation about the future, even though the voice of the psalm gives no hint about how to get from here to there. And it's this second reading of questioning, this second reading of the status quo of injustice, which spoke to me as I considered this psalm and considered the blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Because I find this, out of maybe all of the Beatitudes, hardest to kind of put into practice and kind of figure out how this is wonderful news for those who are in a situation of meekness, who are a situation of being oppressed or being afflicted or being put down. How is this wonderful news? And to kind of get to the beginning of the answer, we have to talk about a few other things about how this works out. And the first one is, what is it to be meek? And Webster's dictionary highlights that this is an enduring injury with patience and without resentment. And this kind of corresponds to Brueggemann's second reading a little bit, even though in the Psalms there's a certain longing, desire that the wicked will then be, have it turned against them, that they will be then dealt with in a violent manner. The Greek word for meekness kind of pulls in the idea of humility a little bit more than the idea of affliction. The Hebrew word really has the idea of being affliction, being in a place of suffering, being pushed down and being oppressed. And this kind of frames the two aspects of this discussion about how this is wonderful news. And to deal with this, I'd like to talk about Jesus and talk about Holy Week. And this begins with Matthew 21. And Matthew 21 begins what is called the triumphal entry, or what I called, when talking on Palm Sunday, the so-called triumphal entry, because it doesn't resonate with what a triumphal entry is in the context of the ancient world. It was a celebration of victory, a celebration where the war spoils were put on display. And this is not what Jesus did as he rode into Jerusalem. Their expectations were that the Messiah would take up the sword and would fight the Romans. But this was a processional of nonviolence, where at the end of the procession, he would die at the hands of his oppressors and the oppressors of his people, that fit even the definition of the wicked ones who are in Psalm 37. And for this reason, Matthew, as he puts the gospel and as he describes the situation, quotes from Zechariah 9. And this is a profoundly ironic use of the text, as it says, "Look, daughter Zion, behold your king coming to you, meek and riding on a donkey, upon the foal of a donkey." Because Jesus enters Jerusalem for Holy Week as the dawn of the kingdom of heaven is about to break forth into light. And it's Zechariah 9 and this description of a weak, or of a meek king who is not fighting his oppressors, but submits to their suffering, one who is pressed down, one who submits to that. It's a king that is different than their expectations and their hope. The kingdom of heaven has drawn near, and it's radically different than the people expect and the people had hoped for. It's not a way to power through aggression or violence. It's not one that's ushered in through an army or through military force. By the end of the week, Jesus dies as a frail and seemingly failed Messiah, at least in the perspective of his people. The cross and the crucifixion is profoundly confusing. How does this bring wonderful news to the meek? How does this bring hope in the weakness? And to begin the reversal, and to begin the movement out of this into how this is good news, this is wonderful news, is that death is no longer the final answer or the final word. It's no longer the close of the book. The great intimidation of the powers, the people who are in ruling authority, is the right to put their subjects to death. And crucifixion in the Roman Empire was used as this. They were used as examples against people so that people would not rise up or would not question their authority, would not move against them. And that's what the symbol of the cross was in the Roman world. But on that day, the symbol of the cross begins a new symbol, a new word that the meek will inherit the earth, that the power of death is not the final word. The power set himself up against the kingdom of heaven, but Jesus is Lord, and that's what that represents. This becomes a call for us to live into the unfolding of the kingdom of heaven, to engage the powers in the way that Jesus did, and see the way he did in the Gospels, as the way he did in Holy Week. And just to be clear that I'm not specifically arguing for pacifism here. I'm what I would call myself as a reluctant non-pacifist, and it's because I wish I could live in a world where pacifism was possible, where we all lived in respect and harmony, where that could be the case. But I know that there are circumstances that would happen where I would be moved out of my non-pacifism, even if I declared to want to live into that. And I'll talk more about that when we get to Blessed Are the Peacemakers. But what I am arguing is that the kingdom of heaven gives us an opportunity to respond differently to powers, to respond differently to injustice, and to live into a different way of being in the world. And this is a difficult one. It's one that speaks directly to me. When I see or when I'm experiencing injustice, I often respond with desire to cause pain in the same way that I'm seeing happen, or the same way that is experienced in my life. And that's how I often respond. It's how I always responded in sports, and I'm working on that. I haven't been yellow carded yet in soccer this year, which is a good thing. Not that I got yellow cards all the time, but my first response is often to want to respond so the person who is doing the injustice feels the weight of injustice upon themselves. Evil for evil, pain for pain. But the Beatitudes, as I wrestle with this, convict me of this attitude and call me to live into the world differently, where I take a step back from that desire, those intentions, that desire to inflict back injustice on people. And this is what Jesus does as he moves into Jerusalem. But to temper that, the next thing Jesus does as he moves in Holy Week is to judge the temple for the injustice and the way of keeping people down that they've been doing in Jerusalem as he clears the temple and drives the people out. There's this tension of how to respond to injustice. There's this tension of responding in a correct way, but it's always in the background that freedom fighters can easily become the dictators, as we know from the present history of the world. It's not just the case in Rome or in the ancient world, but that's a thing that's also part of our recent history. So what does it mean to inherit the earth? And I'd like to read a little bit from Scott McKnight just here to begin, because he frames it really well and describes the connection point in a good way. This is in his commentary on the Sermon on the Mount. He says, "We must take into consideration what the meek are promised. They will inherit the land, because meekness connects here to land inheritance, and because the Beatitudes are so inherently countercultural, we suggest that meekness is framed over against wrath, anger, violence, acquisitiveness, theft, violent takeovers, and brutal reclamation of property. The meek are unlike the zealots, who use violence to seize the land. The meek choose to absorb unjust conditions in a form of nonviolent, non-retaliatory resistance that creates a calm, countercultural community of love, justice, and peace." Now, McKnight goes on to argue that earth in this text means land, and that's what he has in his translation. And he frames this as being in the land of Israel. And while I would agree that with his argument that the primary view of many Old Testament passages is the land, I think his view is too narrow in what land means here, what earth means here. This always creates a tension with how to translate things. Do you translate things in the how Jesus would have originally said them, how his hearers would have originally heard them, or how Matthew presents them in the gospel, or how it would communicate to present hearers today? And I think as often what Jesus does is he speaks to something that will resonate with the people in their present situation. And they would have been hoping for the restoration of their land. But Jesus often has something grander, something beyond what people could comprehend in mind. And that would be the entire earth, the unfolding of the kingdom of heaven, meeting earth in a powerful and awesome way. In reality, that the whole world is the Lord's and everything in it. And that is what I believe Jesus has here as his extension into meaning, that the meek will inherit the earth. The kingdom of heaven has come near, and this earth is inherited by a way of living into the present, the truth of what the kingdom of heaven is unfolding, of what it will be like when heaven meets earth. And although at times this doesn't appear to be the reality, we are called to be the light of the world, to declare that this is how things are unfolding, as in heaven, so in earth. And this moves to influence how we live as people in the world. It's a call not to use might to push down people, or to use influence to oppress, or to use power grabs as an assertion of will. And this is, in Jesus' day, how society would have functioned, how society would have been done. A rule to power, a way to govern things. And we're called not to engage into that situation of what it means to be successful, what it means to have power, what it means to rise up. We're called to live into a kingdom where those are different, where the kingdom of heaven is unfolding. And it's wonderful news for the meek, for they will inherit the earth. And I find, as I mentioned, this one is a difficult one to deal with, because you see situations of injustice and you want to respond, you want to engage, and you want to help, and you want to stand against injustice. You want to help those who are meek, who are being pressed down, who are being pushed down. And it's interesting that this beatitude is sandwiched right between blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted, and blessed are those who hunger and thirst for justice, for they will be satisfied. Because these are kind of the two opportunities between the situations, mourning for situations of injustice, mourning for situations that are not right, and offering comfort, coming alongside those people to support them when they're in situations of injustice. And also this command to hunger and thirst for justice, to thirst for righteousness, to thirst for God's justice to be present within the world, because they will be satisfied. And it's this meek, for they will inherit the earth, that will sandwich between the two ideas. And as I've been reading through the Beatitudes and thinking about them, Ecclesiastes 3 keeps on coming back to me, or what I like to call Qoheleth 3, keeps on coming back to it. And it's a question of what time is it? What season? What is the right situation? What is the right response? And the last three of this passage says a time to be silent, or a time to speak, a time for love, or a time for hate, a time for war, and a time for peace. And figuring out what time it is and how to respond and how to enact in those situations is the struggle that the teacher Qoheleth has as he wrestles with the way things are in the world and wrestles with what's going on. We see this wrestling with the psalmist. We see this throughout the Old Testament. What does it mean? What time is it? How to respond? How to be faithful to God in these difficult situations and circumstances? Or in the context of Jesus, when to judge the temple because of its injustice that it's working out from, or when to suffer at the hands of the enemies. And figuring out this time is difficult. It's hard to know. The Spirit is at work. The Spirit is making all things new. And the Spirit is promised as a guide to lead us into those situations, to know and to respond, and to respond in the way that God would have us. And it's tough to stand back. It's tough sometimes to trust that the Spirit is at work and the Spirit is moving, and not to engage in such a powerful, or maybe even in a way that's inappropriate, and to just trust that the Spirit is moving. But the answer to what time it is, the time since Jesus rose from the dead, is that we are in the time of the now and not yet of the unfolding kingdom of heaven. And we are called to live into that. We're called to live into that place of truth and integrity and dealing rightly and responding in a way that we don't become the evil that we are working against. The last question I would like to talk about briefly is just peace. What it means to be at peace, be in shalom. And the background of Jesus' time was this peace of Rome, where they had relative peace against where the Roman Empire had relative peace with the surrounding areas, where there wasn't advance of territory. But we see, even in the context of the New Testament, that this was not universal peace. It was still a time of turmoil where military power kept the people from rebelling, and when there was rebelling, they were punished severely and harshly by the Roman Empire. Jesus offers a completely different type of peace, and it's not specifically mentioned in the Beatitudes, even though blessed are the peacemakers are there. And it's surely in the background of Psalm 37, verse 11, because as that verse continues, it discusses delighting themselves, the meek delighting themselves in the abundance of peace, or in abundant peace. And this is shalom, the future hope where everything is made right, where there's right relationships between people, right relationship with God, right relationship with the earth. It is framed by inheriting the land and those who are dwelling in peace in many passages of the Old Testament. And peace is something we all look for, the centering of our life, having our life centered around the Spirit of God, making us new, making us feel whole, making us living in a way of joy and peace. And I know that in my life, when I respond in a place of wanting to do evil, wanting to respond to injustice in a malicious or in an anger or vengeance way, that peace and that centering point of my life then becomes off-center. And that is taken away, and then the joy that I have is gone. And this is a call for me to remember to not respond in a way that is inappropriate, but to respond in a way that God is leading me to. And then I'm not saying that we should be silent and passive, and that we shouldn't call the powers to account and declare that the kingdom of heaven is broken forth and that we need to live in to that. However, we're called to do so in a manner that demonstrates that there's a different way of being in the world, where we don't return injustice for injustice and continue that cycle of injustice in the world, to live in a way that brings peace and brings that centering Spirit of God in our lives. As we transition to the table, I'll use the same transition, or quite similar to the transition I used last week, and that is the proclamation that the table proclaims the Lord's death until he comes. That's what the Holy Week was pushing towards, the crucifixion, the death of our Lord, where he defeated the powers, he defeated oppression, he defeated those who worked against him, he defeated sin by submitting himself to oppression, to suffering, so that by his stripes we may be healed. So as you come to the table, allow it to be a place of healing, a place of restoration, a place of allowing the injustices of the world to be healed by the unfolding kingdom of heaven, recognizing that the kingdom of heaven is breaking forth, and this is the symbol that death is not the end, death is not the final word, and that peace is unfolding through his death and resurrection.